And now, I am going to request the father of our nation, the apostle of love and truth and non-violence, to give us his benediction.
Madam President and friends, I do not think that I should apologize to you for having to speak in a foreign tongue. I wonder if this loudspeaker carries my voice to the farthest end of this vast audience. Will some of those who are far away will raise their hands if they listen to what I'm saying? Do you listen? All right. Well, if my voice doesn't carry, it won't be my fault. It will be the fault of the loudspeaker. But I was going to tell you that I don't need to apologize. I dare not, if all the delegates who have assembled from the various parts of Asia and observers, I learnt the word from the lips of an American friend. He said, I am no delegate, I am an observer. Thinking that he hailed from Persia, from my very few moments, I promised a few moments. Lo and behold, an American stands in front of me, and I told him, I dread you, and I wish you would leave me alone. Do you imagine that an American would leave me alone? Not he. And therefore, I had to speak to him. But I was going to tell you that my provincial speech, which is my mother tongue, you can't understand, and I don't want to insult you by insisting on the provincial speech. The national speech, Hindustani. I know that it will be a long time before it can rival an international speech. If there is rivalry, there is rivalry between French and English. For international commerce, undoubtedly, English occupies the first place. For diplomatic speech and correspondence, I used to hear when I was studying in my boyhood that French was the language of diplomacy. And if you wanted to go from one end of Europe to the other end, you must try to pick up French. And so I tried to pick up a few words of French in order that I might be able to make myself understood. Anyway, if there is any rivalry at all, the rivalry lies between French and English. Therefore, having been taught English, naturally I have to resort to speaking to you to that international speech. I was wondering what I was to speak to you. I wanted to collect my thoughts, but let me confess to you that I had no time. And yet I had promised yesterday that I will try to say a few words to you. Whilst I was coming with Badshah Khan, I asked for a little piece of paper and pencil. I got a pen instead of a pencil. I tried to scribble a few words. You will be sorry to hear from me that piece of paper is not by my side. But that is nothing. I remember what I wanted to think out. And I said to myself, you friends have seen not the real India, and you are not meeting in conference in the midst of real India. Delhi, Bombay, Madras, Calcutta, Lahore, all these are big cities, and therefore, having come under the influence of the West, having been made also, Delhi perhaps accepted, having been, but not New Delhi, having been made also by the English. I then thought of a little essay, I suppose I should call it, which was in French, and it was translated for me by an Anglo-French friend. And he was a philosopher. He was also an unselfish man. And he said, he befriended me without my having known him, because he always sided with the minority. And I was, that is my countrymen, in a hopeless minority. Not only hopeless minority, but a despised minority. If the Europeans of South Africa will forgive me for saying so. We were all coolies. I was an insignificant coolie lawyer. At that time, we had no coolie doctors. We had no coolie lawyers. I was the first in the field. Nevertheless, a coolie. You know perhaps what is meant by the word coolie. But this friend, his name was Cole. His mother was a French woman. His father was an Englishman. And he said, I want to translate for you a French story. You will pardon me, those of you who know this story, if I make mistakes in recalling it here and there, but there will be no mistake in the main incident. There were three scientists, and they, of course it is an imaginary story, three scientists went out from France, went out of Europe in search of truth. That was the first lesson that story taught me, that if truth was to be searched, it was not to be found on the soil of Europe. Therefore, undoubtedly not in America. These three great scientists went to different parts of Asia. One of them found his way to India, and he began his search. He went to the so-called cities of those times. Naturally, this was before British occupation, before even the Mughal period. That is how the French author has illustrated the story. But still, he went through the cities. He saw the so-called high caste people, men and women, till at last he penetrated a humble cottage in a humble village, and that cottage was a Bhangi cottage. And he found the truth that he was in search of in that Bhangi cottage, in the Bhangi family, man, woman, perhaps two or three children. I speak there under correction. And then he describes how he found it. I omit all that thing. I want to connect that story with what I want to say to you, that if you really want to see India at its best, you have to find it in a Bhangi cottage, in a humble Bhangi home. Of such villages, so the English historians teach us are 700,000. A few cities here and there, they don't hold several crores of people, but the 700,000 villages do hold nearly 40 crores of people. I say nearly because you may take away 1 crore perhaps. Maybe 2 crores in these cities, still there will be 38 crores. And then I said to myself, if these friends go away without finding their true India, what will they have found? I then thought that I would beseech you to imagine this India, not from this vast audience, but to imagine what it would be like. Then I would like you to read a story such as this brilliant story of Frenchmen or other things. See perhaps some of you a few villages of India, then you will find real India. Today, I will make this admission also that you will not be fascinated by the sight. You will have then to scratch down below the dung heaps that the villages are today. I don't pretend to say that they were ever places of paradise, but today they are really dung heaps. They were not like that before, of that I am quite sure, but that I speak not from history, but from what I have seen myself with my physical eyes of India, and I have travelled from one India of end of India to the other, seen these villages, seen the miserable specimens of humanity, lusterless eyes, and yet they are India. And yet in those humble cottages, in the midst of those dung heaps, are to be found the humble bhangis, where you will find concentrated essence of wisdom. How? That is a great question. Well, then I want to take you to another scene. Again, I have learned from books written by English historians, translated for me. All this knowledge, I'm sorry to say, comes to us here in India through English books, through English historians. Not that there are not Indian historians, but they also don't write in their mother tongue or in the national language Hindustani, or if you prefer to call them two speeches, Hindi and Urdu, two forms of the same speech. No, they give us what they have studied through English books, then perhaps through originals, but through English, in the English tongue. That is the cultural conquest of India, that India has, through which India has undergone. But they tell us that wisdom came to the West from the East. And who are these wise men? Zoroaster. He belonged to the East. He was followed by Buddha. He belonged to the East. He belonged to India. Who followed Buddha? Jesus, again from Asia. Before Jesus was Musa, Moses, also belonging to Palestine, though born, I was just checking myself, so Badshah Khan and Yunus Sahib, and they both corroborated me that Moses belonged to Palestine, though he was born in Egypt. And then came Jesus, then came Muhammad. All these, I omit Krishna, I omit Mahavir, I omit the other lights, I won't call them lesser lights, but unknown to the West, unknown to the literary world. All the same, I don't know a single person to match these men of Asia. And then what happened? Christianity became disfigured when it went to the West. I'm sorry to have to say that, but that is my reading. I won't take you any further through this. I give you this story in order to hearten you and in order to make you understand, if my poor speech can make you understand, that what you see of the splendor and everything that the cities of India has to show you is not real India. Certainly the carnage that is going on before your very eyes, sorry, shameful. As I said yesterday, you have to bury it here. Don't carry the memory of that carnage beyond the confines of India. But what I want you to understand, if you can, that the message of the East, the message of Asia, is not to be learned through European spectacles, through the Western spectacles, not by imitating the tinsel of the West, the gunpowder of the West, the atom bomb of the West. If you want to give a message again to the West, it must be a message of love. It must be a message of truth. There must be a conquest. Please, please, please. That will interfere with my speech, and that will interfere with your understanding also. I want to capture your hearts and don't want to receive your claps. Let your hearts clap in unison with what I am saying, and I think I shall have finished my work. Therefore, I want you to go away with the thought that Asia has to conquer the West. Then the question that a friend asked yesterday, did I believe in one world? Of course I believe in one world. And how can I possibly do otherwise when I become an inheritor of the message of love that these great unconquerable teachers left for us? You can re-deliver that message now in this age of democracy, in the age of awakening of the poorest of the poor. You can re-deliver this message with the greatest emphasis. Then you will complete the conquest of the whole of the West, not through vengeance, because you have been exploited. And in the exploitation, of course, I want to include Africa. And I hope that when next you meet in India, all the exploited nations of the earth will meet, if by that time there are any exploited nations of the earth. I am so sanguine that if all of you put your hearts together, not merely your heads, but hearts together, and understand the secret of the messages of all these wise men of the East has left to us, and if we really become worthy of that great message, then you will easily understand that the conquest of the West will be completed, and that conquest will be loved by the West itself. West is today pining for wisdom. West today is despairing of multiplication of atom bombs, because a multiplication of atom bombs means utter destruction, not merely of the West, but it will be in a destruction of the world, as if the prophecy of the Bible is going to be fulfilled and there is to be a perfect deluge. Heaven forbid that there will be that deluge. And through man's wrong against himself, it is up to you to deliver the whole world, not merely Asia, but deliver the whole world from that wickedness, from that sin. That is the precious heritage your teachers, my teachers, have left to us.
The leader of the Chinese delegation wishes to perform some pretty ceremonies concerning Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru and probably myself. May I call upon the leader of the Chinese delegation to do so?
Pandiji and friends, at this morning's plenary session, it was the unanimous opinion of all the delegates present that the next Asian Relations Conference should be held 2 years hence in China. On behalf of the Chinese delegation, I wish to extend to you all at this call to the whole world.
Friends and fellow Asians, what has brought you here, men and women of Asia? Why have you come from the various countries of this mother continent of ours and gathered together in the ancient city of Delhi? Some of us, greatly daring, sent you invitation for this conference, and you gave a warm welcome to this invitation. And yet, it was not merely that call from us, but some deeper urge that brought you here. We stand at the end of an era and on the threshold of a new period of history, standing on this watershed which divides two epochs of human history and endeavor. We can look back on our long past and look forward to the future that is taking shape before our eyes. Asia, after a long period of quiescence, has suddenly become important again in world affairs. If we view the millennia of history, this continent of Asia, with which Egypt has been so intimately connected in cultural fellowship, has played a mighty role in the evolution of humanity. It was here that civilization began and man started on his unending adventure of life. Here, the mind of man searched unceasingly for truth, and the spirit of man shone out like a beacon which lighted up the whole world. This dynamic Asia, from which great streams of culture flowed in all directions, gradually became static and unchanging. Other peoples and other continents came to the fore and with their new dynamism spread out and took possession of great parts of the world. This mighty continent became just a field for the rival imperialisms of Europe, and Europe became the center of history and progress in human affairs. A change is coming over the scene now, and Asia is again finding herself. We live in a tremendous age of transition, and already the next stage takes shape when Asia takes her rightful place with the other continents. It is at this great moment that we meet here, and it is the pride and privilege of the people of India to welcome their fellow Asians from other countries. To confer with them about the present and the future, and to lay the foundations of our mutual progress, well-being and friendship. The idea of having an Asian conference is not new, and many have thought of it. It is indeed surprising that it should not have been held many years earlier. Yet perhaps the time was not ripe for it, and any attempt to do so would have been superficial and not in tune with world events. It so happened that we in India convened this conference, but the idea of such a conference arose simultaneously in many minds and in many countries of Asia. There was a widespread urge and an awareness that the time had come for us, peoples of Asia, to meet together, to hold together, and to advance together. It was not only a vague desire, but a compulsion of events that forced us, all of us, to think along these lines. Because of this, the invitation we in India sent out brought an answering echo and a magnificent response from every country of Asia. We welcome you, delegates and representatives from China, that great country to which Asia owes so much and from which so much is expected. From Egypt and the Arab countries of Western Asia, inheritors of a proud culture which spread far and wide and influenced India greatly. From Iran, whose contacts with India go back to the dawn of history. From Indonesia and Indochina, whose history is intertwined with India's culture. And where recently the battle of freedom has continued, a reminder to us that freedom must be won and cannot come as a gift. From Turkey, that has been rejuvenated by the genius of a great leader. From Korea and Mongolia, Siam, Malaya, and the Philippines. From the Soviet republics of Asia, which have advanced so rapidly in our generation and which have so many lessons to teach us, and from our neighbors, Afghanistan, Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan, Burma and Ceylon, to whom we look specially for cooperation and close and friendly intercourse. Asia is very well represented at this conference, and if one or two countries have been unable to send representatives, this was due to no lack of desire on their part or ours, but circumstances beyond our control came in the way. We welcome also observers from Australia and New Zealand, because we have many problems in common, especially in the Pacific and in the Southeast region of Asia, and we have to cooperate together to find solutions. As we meet here today, the long past of Asia rises up before us. The troubles of recent years fade away, and a thousand memories revive. But I shall not speak to you of these past ages with their glories and triumphs and failures, nor of more recent times which have oppressed us so much and which still pursue us in some measure.